I must commend our speakers for keeping so well to their time, and I'm endeavouring to keep us to our time, that we finish on time. Our final speaker this morning is one who is well known to us. I was listening to BBC Radio Foyle. Now, not many of you do that, I would imagine. But I was listening to BBC Radio Foyle last week, and I heard a voice that I thought I recognised, and he was giving opinions as to whether the Pope's visit was a success or not. And it was this man here, who is known now to speak on religious matters on all sorts of media, globally, I dare say, if we get as far as Derry. David Quinn was the editor of the Irish Catholic. He is now still a contributor to the Sunday Times, the Sunday Business Post. He contributes to the Irish Independent Weekly, and to the Irish Catholic as well as to many other forms of media. But he's also the organizer of Today, and for that, as well as for the other things, we give him a round of applause and welcome him to the podium.
Thank you to Professor Trigg for a fantastic talk. In fact, I should really just stand down and let him give a second session, really, while we have him here, and I'm going to get this going. Just a couple of logistical things again. There should be a couple of clipboards handed out shortly for whoever wants to give us their email if we don't already have it and would like us to send out, you know, the talks given today. Professor Trigg mentioned, or I think it was mentioned, he's done a pamphlet called Free to Believe, for an organisation in Britain called Theos, T-H-E-O-S. And I think it's theos.co.uk, but you'll find it anyway if you put in Theos into a search engine, and you'll be able to download this from their website. We'll create a link on our website to it as well. And it's obviously going to be a very useful thing to read because it just further expands on what the professor was saying. Now, just again, let me get this thing going. Also, in terms of the basket, for anybody who might like to make a donation, to make it even more voluntary, we're not going to pass it around for the audience, but there's two baskets outside where we've left our material. And again, anybody's free to take any material they wish. It's just some of our past publications on issues like the ethics of assisted human reproduction, the future of denominational schools, the whole debate about gay civil partnerships and what's at stake in that debate. I've called this talk The New Moral Absolutism, because in a way I think that's what we're dealing with. And another name for the talk could have been the dictatorship of relativism, because I think that is also what we're talking about. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to kind of hopefully further illuminate what we're dealing with here, what form the dictatorship of relativism takes, and its effects. And I'm going to give particular reference obviously to Ireland, but also to some overseas cases as well that further illuminate it. So, a word on moral relativism, because the professor is not the only one losing sleep at night over the meaning of moral relativism and the other types. So, as he said, and this is now a journalist perspective, so any philosophical slip-ups can be corrected afterwards. So, the belief generally is no objective moral standards, so nobody can say that this is simply wrong as a matter of objective standard, and this is right as a matter of objectivity. Instead, there's one person's truth and another person's truth. And one person's truth is as good as anyone else's. Now, that's, you know, a very broad statement and a simplification. But that, I mean, kind of in popular culture is what's generally meant. One lifestyle choice is as valid as any other. Is my voice echoing slightly? It's okay, okay. All beliefs, all lifestyles should be treated as equal. And so this is why we go very quickly from moral relativism into the equality agenda as being currently defined and enforced increasingly by law. Because if all beliefs are a matter of opinion, and no moral beliefs are worth any more than any other moral belief, pretty much, it makes no sense to treat one lifestyle as superior to any other lifestyle, and we must treat them all as being equal. Except, of course, when I say all lifestyles should be treated as equal, except for those which do not concede that all beliefs and lifestyles should be treated as equal. And that is the paradox of moral relativism, because it's not relativistic about itself. And again, I mean, this is completely paradoxical. All beliefs should be treated as equal, except for those which don't treat all beliefs as equal. But it's immediately a problem for religious believers of whatever persuasion, because, of course, we do believe that there are objective truths, and we often disagree with one another about what they are. Thankfully, we've got much more polite about that. But nonetheless, we're held to be objectionable because we do in fact believe that certain truths are objective, certain moral codes are objective, and this runs extremely foul of moral relativism, which says, no, you just can't say that because it's offensive. And I think one of the reasons why elite liberal opinion bears down so hard on Pope Benedict is because he's a very, you know, he is the obviously the most high-profile religious leader in the Western world. He carries the flag for the idea that morality is not relative. So if you can crush him, you have further advanced the cause of moral relativism. So he becomes a lightning rod for a great deal of the anger that relativists feel towards anybody who thinks that there's objective standards. So we see various religious symbols there getting thrown in the bin. So the rise of the equality agenda. So as I say, relativism and the equality agenda go hand in hand. If all lifestyles are equal, then they must be treated equally before the law. They must also be treated as of equal status and dignity by ordinary people. Now, what I mean by that is, it's not just good enough to treat them as completely equal before the law. In our speech, in our attitudes and so on, we must treat them as exactly equal and of equal worth and dignity. And of course, I mean, we must always be polite. But the reasons that, you know, we talk about political correctness and politically incorrect speech is, if you talk about people as though they are somehow worth less than other people, well, that's politically incorrect. And of course, again, you know, there is a very valid kind of and legitimate point of view behind this, but of course it reaches absurdities, and I mean, this is a caricature to some extent when we talk about things like differently abled, you know, for example, because if we use any other phrase, we might be causing offence, and this is kind of when we get to the kind of wilder shores of politically correct concern for the kind of speech we use. But anyway, this gives rise to the call to celebrate diversity. And my answer to that is, well, what is the content of the diversity you're asking us to celebrate? Because I think that's what matters. The various public education campaigns asking us to celebrate diversity. So the equality agenda and Christianity. So the equality agenda, and you see, again, I wish I could find a better name for it. I wish we could all find a better name for it, because, of course, equality is a good and noble concept. And when we say we're concerned about aspects of the equality agenda, well, it kind of puts us on the losing side, doesn't it, in the eyes of public opinion, which is why I kind of increasingly talk about equality absolutism. Because, again, this is the paradox. It comes in the name of relativism, but is rather absolutist. So I often talk about this new moral absolutism or equality absolutism. But anyway, we talk about the equality agenda. It challenges the church, and I mean that in the broader sense, in many areas. Faith-based schools come under attack. The view of men, women, and sexuality comes under attack because, again, if you'd say that there's inherent and intrinsic distinctions between men and women and intrinsic differences, you're being sexist, for example. Obviously, if you believe in traditional sexual morality, you're being homophobic. And so on. The view of the family comes under attack. I'll expand on all these. The role of the church in public life comes under attack in ways already described and as I'll further describe. So let's have a look at the attack in faith-based schools. Their enrollment policies, we're told, discriminate. We heard from Neil about the Jewish school that's no longer allowed to say who's a Jew and who's not, as prescribed by Orthodox Judaism. And, of course, Church of Ireland schools discriminate because they prefer to give a place to Church of Ireland children. Catholic schools discriminate because they prefer to give a place to Catholic children. And, of course, in all cases, I mean, there's a great mixture of kids in these schools, but they do have a policy that favours people of their own denomination, and this, of course, discriminates and shouldn't be allowed. Their employment policies discriminate because, you know, a religious school to maintain its ethos has to be able to employ people who are at least respectful of the ethos, even if they don't believe in it. But we're increasingly being told this discriminates, that you must employ the local atheist if it's only to teach maths, that they shrink it down to the only person who has to respect the ethos is the religion teacher. Everybody else doesn't have to, whether by lifestyle or by what they say in class or whatever the case. And in Irish law, there's something called the Employment Equality Act, and there is in that act something called Section 37, which is extremely important. And Section 37 protects the right of religious organisations to employ staff who will at least respect their ethos. And this is coming under huge pressure to be repealed. What our schools teach, is discriminatory, apparently, because if we teach traditional sexual morality, we are discriminating against people who don't conform to traditional sexual morality. So, if our enrollment policies get repealed, if our employment policies are attacked, and if the content of what we teach is attacked, there's not much left to being a faith-based school, is there? I mean, they become empty shells, in effect. It's called a Catholic school, it's called an Anglican school, but they're devoid of content, practically. Of course, the idea that states that faith-based schools should receive any public funding at all, we're told, violates the principle of church-state separation, and we should go to something like the model they've got in America, where not a cent goes to any faith-based schools at all. May I say, by the way, the American situation is rather unusual, that in most countries, faith-based schools do receive public funding because many citizens are religious, and they are taxpayers. And therefore, it makes sense if there's sufficient demand that faith-based schools receive some tax funding. So in Britain, for example, publicly funded schools, about a third of publicly funded schools are faith-based, either mainly Church of England, but also Catholic. So there's nothing unusual about the fact that faith-based schools in Ireland receive public funding. The only thing that's unusual in the Irish situation is that so very many of our schools are faith-based, probably too many for the real level of demand these days, which is subtly conceded by the Catholic Church, and in fact, I think by all the churches pretty much. But they're not going to give up the principle that faith-based schools should receive some public funding support. So the attack on marriage, which seems to be what has been taking up most of my time for the last couple of years, if all lifestyle choices are equal, then so obviously are all families. It is therefore wrong to favour marriage in the law and in the eyes of society. That is to give it special status, institutional status. And one of the handouts today is called Made for Children, and basically why marriage has special status. So this is further explained in that, and it's only a short one. So it's easy to get through, I hope. It's judgmental and intolerant to favour marriage. Okay, this is a reference to a vote in California on Proposition 8, which was an attempt, a successful attempt, in fact, to uphold the traditional definition of marriage as between one man and one woman. But, of course, a court in California recently struck that down, even though 54% of the people had voted in favour of traditional marriage in a liberal state like California, take note. In 30 states out of 30, by the way, where Americans have voted on the marriage issue, the traditional marriage position has won, no matter whether the state be conservative, liberal, or middle of the road. This particular case in Proposition 8 is now working its way to the Supreme Court. So we must recognise and celebrate family diversity, and this includes obviously same-sex families. I'll just go back a step. Again, just to elaborate slightly here, and I'll probably elaborate on it a little bit further on. The principle of equal treatment, we all agree with this. The principle of equal treatment says you must treat similar situations in similar ways. But it allows you to treat different situations in different ways, which is just eminently sensible, that you don't treat two dissimilar situations similarly. You see, what we've been told here is you must treat all types of families exactly equally before the law, the exact same benefits and so on, the exact same amount of social recognition, because they're all exactly the same. But in fact, they're not. Because all the evidence... Now, this is not to say that families that are not based in marriage shouldn't get respect and shouldn't be helped when they're in need. That is absolutely not the case. They must, all families in need must be respected. All families in need must be helped. But all the evidence is also that the family based in marriage, because it gives a child a mother and a father, their own mother and father usually, who have made a public commitment to one another, that this is most beneficial to children. So therefore, you see, there is a rational reason to give marriage special status. Society has an interest in trying to maximise the number of children, without using coercion, who are raised by the two people who brought that child into the world. And it would be an extraordinary society that didn't care anymore whether the people who bring a child into the world raise that child or not. And in fact, this is exactly where we're going now, in the name of a false tolerance and in the name of a very misguided notion of equality, that we don't care. And when we hear about let's celebrate family diversity, what we're actually hearing really is let's celebrate more and more kids not being raised by the two people who brought them into the world. The number of kids in Ireland who, you know, were not being raised by their own two married parents 20 years ago was about 12%. Now it's 26%. And are we to keep celebrating as it rises perhaps to 50% over time? And again, you know, circumstance can intervene in the life of someone and it can deprive a child of a mother and father through nobody's fault at all. It's not through choice, it's through circumstance, and we've got to allow for this, and we can't go back to the coercive way that we used to impose traditional sexual morality in the past. But we simply cannot be neutral between family forms when family forms are not neutral between children, when there is a particular type of family that is in the best interest of children. So, the state, of course, is not morally neutral as it claims to be, because it is all about, and increasingly about, imposing this new form of equality absolutism. The state's agenda, as I say, is the imposition of this agenda. And so, hearing about people who don't conform with this, it occurs to me that, Catholic society in Spain in the 16th century, woe betide those who did not conform. Britain in the 16th, 17th century, also woe betide those who did not conform. But over time, there would be a certain amount of tolerance, but you had the idea of non-conformity, and if you didn't conform, you probably had to take yourself off to the United States like the Pilgrim Fathers did, for example. We are entering a new era where we basically have non-conformists, the people who do not conform to the state-imposed equality agenda. And so getting told you can't work as a civil registrar. In the case of Rocco Bottiglione, the Italian politician who was nominated to the European Commission as Justice Commissioner, being told you can't take this job because you believe things that Christians believe about sexuality, etc. You can't have this job either. So these are non-conformists. And they're being told effectively that Catholics or Christians need not apply to these jobs. And the number of jobs where there's effectively a no Christian need apply job being hung on their front door is increasing all the time. So we have a new kind of non-conformity emerging. And the non-conformists are being placed increasingly on the wrong side of the law. And that means us increasingly being placed on the wrong side of the law. So we see history beginning to repeat itself. But the people who are causing history to repeat itself have no idea, really, that they are turning us into non-conformists. We never thought this was ever going to happen, but it's what's happening. So as I say, we call this equality absolutism because it's a less flattering term than the equality agenda, and I think, frankly, more accurate. So this equality absolutism subordinates all other social and personal goods to the super good of equality as it gets defined. And as I repeat, we all agree with the principle of equal treatment, treat similar situations similarly, but different situations in different ways. And they won't allow us as Christians to say, we don't think these two situations are the same, therefore we're going to treat them differently. We're suddenly accused of being bigots if we say things like that. And you see, what you'll notice is that any opposition to this agenda, you get accused of one or another type of prejudice. You're sexist, you're racist, you're homophobic, you're fundamentalist, and so on. And you see, this is why this agenda thinks it has permission to use the law against us and create laws against us, because we are guilty of prejudice. We are not being rational. And the law can have no place for irrationality and prejudice. And we heard John Gormley talking about how our belief in traditional sexual morality and marriage is an old and discredited prejudice. And once you have yourself convinced this is an old and discredited prejudice, and that's all it is, and has no rational basis whatsoever, it then becomes extremely easy to give yourself permission to use the law against such benighted creatures. And so we have again the old Catholic idea, error has no rights, coming into a new form, in a form of a kind of strange and warped type of liberalism. But not only does error have no rights, those in error have no rights either. And so we see this back in a new guise. So this equality absolutism is monist, I hope I'm using that word correctly, in outlook, not pluralist. Because pluralism, properly defined, is supposed to allow people to have different values, all right? And it's supposed to accommodate these different values as much as is reasonably possible. And increasingly, that is not happening. One value is coming to dominate everything, and everything is becoming subordinate to it. The right to free speech, the right to free association, and so on, are made subordinate to this right to equality. So the Pope, of course, calls this the dictatorship of relativism, because in the name of relativism, all lifestyle choices must get treated equally, whether you like it or not, and you will be forced to do so. So that's where the dictatorship comes in. Equality absolutism in Ireland. There's this attempt to repeal Section 37 of the Employment Equality Act that I mentioned earlier that allows religious organisations to employ staff who will respect their ethos at the least. So the Irish National Teachers Organisation and the Labour Party, too, a recent motion at their annual conference, voted for the repeal of this. It is regularly attacked in the Senate by the likes of Senator David Norris. If this gets taken away, it becomes much harder for religious schools to maintain their ethos. So we discovered again that making religious freedom subordinate to the equality agenda attacks another right. And so we don't have pluralism, we have monism. And in fact, the Iona Institute was attacked at the INTO conference there a few months ago because we're one of the principal defenders of Section 37. I often think that I'll adopt a new slogan for the Iona Institute, fighting the dictatorship of relativism since 2006. That's when we were founded. So we've got the general campaign overall against faith-based schools that they shouldn't exist even, shouldn't receive state-based funding. And if they're going to exist, should be purely funded out of their own pockets and the pockets of the parents who send their kids to them. There was Dr. Phil Boyle earlier this year. Dr. Phil Boyle is a fertility treatment. He runs a fertility treatment service in Galway Clinic. I think he's practiced in Dublin now as well. And basically, because he runs his practice in accordance with Catholic teaching, he will only treat married couples. So a cohabiting couple came and wanted to be treated, and he basically he couldn't accept his patients because of his beliefs, and he was complained to the Fitness to Practice Committee of the Irish Medical Council on a charge of professional misconduct. And this was entertained incredibly by the Fitness to Practice Committee because he is, quote-unquote, discriminating. Now, again, you see, from our point of view, he's not in the classic sense. He's not treating two similar situations similarly. Marriage is different from cohabitation. Cohabiting parents notoriously break up much more often than married parents. If you are raised by cohabiting parents, you are twice as likely to see them break up compared with if you have been raised by married parents. So there's every reason, if you have a child's interest at heart, to say, look, we're only going to treat married couples. We're going to only offer our fertility treatment service to married couples. But that belief is treated as a form of irrationality, simply prejudice, simply bigotry. Now, he got off his charge, but only as far as I can ascertain on a technicality. So this is very much the type of thing happening. And like when it happened, a lot of callers to radio stations were attacking him. How dare he, quote unquote, discriminate, even though in the proper sense it wasn't discrimination. So it's already been referred to the refusal to include a conscience clause in the Civil Partnership Act. And in fact, the Church of Ireland's Social Policy Committee submitted a proposal on this conscience clause to the government. It was an extremely modest proposal and absolutely unceremoniously refused. And people were receiving letters from the Department of Justice saying, nobody, this is so amazingly totalitarian, no one can be exempt from their obligation not to discriminate. No one can be exempt from their obligation not to discriminate. So if that is not the dictatorship of relativism in action, nothing is. Because the state is suddenly saying, this is your moral obligation. This is our view. You're not allowed to disagree with this. And then you're compared to racists when you do. And this is often comes up, by the way, in the debates I be in. This is like refusing interracial marriage. It's not. Nobody ever believed that the marriage of a black person and a white person wasn't a marriage. The opposition to interracial marriage was based on completely bogus theories of racial purity. Here we're talking about something quite different. There's a reason to give special status to an institution that gives a child a mother and a father. So it's like comparing chalk with cheese. But we are getting compared to racist bigots. The majority of Irish people would still believe, ideally, a child should be raised by their own two biological parents, and you'd been called a bigot if you believe that. So you see the bullying nature of this agenda, and you can see again how easily it gives itself permission to treat us as benighted and to place us in conflict with the law in increasing ways. I mentioned Section 37. There should be, of the Employment Equality Act, there should be a similar section in the Equal Status Act, which is all about provision of goods and services, and you're not allowed to discriminate in provisions of goods and services regardless of your beliefs. No reasonable accommodation whatsoever. So 15 years ago, when the Employment Equality Act was being passed, they saw fit to put in a protection for religious organisations. Only 4 years later, when this was passed, no such provision, gone. I warrant, by the way, that that's unconstitutional. The Irish Constitution, Article 44, is quite robust in its defence of religious freedom and conscience. That Equal Status Act was never tested. I wonder what would happen if it was. There's a very false view of church-state separation being put about. For example, and he was referred to earlier, we have our Justice Minister saying that religion shouldn't be allowed to cloud the judgment of politicians, which is just such an incredibly insulting notion, that the only thing religion can do is cloud the judgment of a politician. I mean, I cynically add, as if the various vested interests couldn't possibly cloud their judgment and didn't lead the country to economic ruination. But so it's only religion that which they have to worry about. So it's a deeply offensive notion that's the only thing religion can do is cloud the judgment rather than enlighten the judgment of politicians. That religious values should be left outside the door of politicians' offices, which begs the question, what values are you bringing in? Because you must be bringing in some values or you're a nihilist. The belief that traditional morality is a discredited prejudice, which was basically our Environment Minister John Gormley. That the state has no right to intrude, the church has no right to intrude on matters of state, a very loaded word, intrude. As though, by the way, that something like family policy is simply a matter for the state, as though what happens in our society is to be decided only by the state, and that the church and religious believers, even though we live in society, are allowed to have no opinion about the laws that affect the society in which we too live. So we're reduced to a kind of second-class citizenship. You're not allowed to have an opinion on this, except in the privacy of your brain, which, as Professor Trigg said, is a formula any totalitarian state would be happy to live with. The bishops should stick to the spiritual needs of their flocks, so you're told, know your place. What we need to do to combat this kind of equality absolutism is to define church-state separation properly. Very loosely, what it means is the church should not be in a position to control the state and impose its will upon the state undemocratically, but nor should the state be allowed to do likewise to the church, except in extreme circumstances. And we have increasingly is church-state separation being violated, not by the church, but by the state, because the state is increasingly putting itself on the side of this equality absolutism and feeling perfectly free to impose itself upon religious organisations like the Catholic Adoption Agencies in Britain, and upon religious believers like our doctor friend in Galway. So we have the state violating church-state separation, can I suggest. It does not mean that the church can't seek to influence the laws, however, because any citizen should be allowed to influence the law. And we say the church, that's a way of saying us, because we're in the church. What we're saying is religious believers have to be allowed to influence society just like anybody else can. It doesn't mean the separation of church from society. I've coined a phrase recently which I call Eric Honecker secularism, which is a rather obscure reference, but I'll explain it. Eric Honecker was the leader of East Germany at the time the Berlin Wall fell down, or was brought down, and he had been leader for about 20 years or something. And as one of Professor Trigg's books explains, that over time, of course, the communist attitude to religion somewhat evolved. In the early days, it sought to exterminate religion, completely crush it, and extirpate it from society. And then when it discovered it can't quite do that, instead what it said was, okay, you have freedom of worship, full stop. There are certain jobs that Christians simply cannot do. Obviously, no politician is going to be allowed to let religion cloud their judgment. Okay. That's all that will be left to you. So you had a type of secularism imposed that reduced freedom of religion purely to freedom of worship. And so again, we heard cases being referred to, hey, you're free not to take this job, or you're free to be sacked, and you can still go into your church on Sunday and worship. So that's what's happening there. They are circumscribing in a very extreme way, and it's actually coming to resemble what would have existed in East Germany circa 1975. You can worship, that's it. In every other respect, you're a second-class citizenship. So that's why I call the type of secularism that the aggressive secularists are trying to impose upon us Eric Honecker secularism. I wish I had a picture of him, because he's a very grim-looking fellow. It doesn't mean the separation of church and state, and I should of course say it doesn't mean the relegation of religion to the private sphere, as happened in these East European societies, once they stopped trying to exterminate us and impose what amounted to a final solution upon religion, its total extermination from society. Separation of church and state, as I said, works both ways. The state can also easily be a threat to the independence of the church, and the church has often had to fight for its independence and even its survival against this threat. And I mentioned an excellent book by historian Michael Burley called Earthly Powers, that is a history of church-state relations from the French Revolution up to 1914, and my goodness, is that book an eye-opener. It takes a lot of work, because every page is packed with dense detail, but it's such an eye-opener. And then a second volume is called Sacred Causes, which goes from World War II up to the present day. But that's the one I'd most highly recommend for those who are very interested in this topic. So, to combat it, ironically, we need to relativize equality. It's not the only value that matters. There's other values like freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience. So we need to relativize the relativizers. Point out that it's only one value among others, and there has to be a balance found between all these values. Incidentally, Professor Trigg was mentioned in the European Court of Human Rights and this case in Germany that you couldn't sack the choir master, was it?
Organist.
Even though adultery and bigamy. It's quite a list. The justification what? That he has the right to his private family life. I wish he'd respected his own private family life, but anyway. The European Council, or the Council of Europe with its Parliamentary Assembly, is going to be shortly debating a motion on the need to regulate conscientious objection. And the proposal is to establish a registry of conscientious objectors in hospitals. And the idea behind this is anybody who turns up at any publicly funded hospital must be able to have an abortion, even if there's a conscientious objection in that hospital. And if it happens to be the case that you're the only doctor that night and you have a conscientious objection, you must perform the abortion. So you want to keep if this proposal was to go through and it was ever to become law, thank God we are not subject to laws of the Council of Europe at this stage. The Council of Europe is different from the European Union, but fancy that, a registry of conscientious objectors. Can you just imagine anything more sinister or totalitarian than having to register, if you have conscientious objection, to abortion? So equality is an important value, but one among others, and sometimes it does run counter to rationality and evidence. So I already explained in the area of family policy and marriage, the idea of, you know, that there's no special benefits to children having married parents. That runs entirely counter to the evidence. You know, with regard to adoption, for example, and the Catholic adoption agencies, it makes perfect sense to try and match a child up with a mother and father. That's not an irrational, discredited, and old prejudice, to put it in the words of one of our ministers. So, again, what values are being compromised when you make equality the overriding value? So in the case of schools, well, the rights of parents to send their kids to a school of their choice gets compromised. With regard to ethos, your ethos gets compromised. You must employ teachers who don't respect your ethos. Where does religious freedom come in? With regard to religious teaching, what is the place of freedom of speech? Because again, as Neil Addison was saying, increasingly Christians find themselves on the wrong side of so-called anti-hate crime laws. We're guilty of hate speech, literal thought crimes. I repeat again, it is not discrimination to treat different situations in different ways. We must repeat that till the cows come home. We are all in favour of the principle of equal treatment, but it must be explained exactly what it means. That it doesn't mean we need to treat different situations similarly. And so the whole debate often comes down to, is it legitimate to treat these two situations differently? And what the state increasingly is telling us, no, it's not. We have decided that you must treat those two situations the same, even though it's your profound belief and you have it backed by evidence that they are not the exact same type of situations, and therefore they warrant different treatments. And we must, you know, continue to say that there's other values here that must be held in balance with equal rights. Because equal rights are very important, but there's other rights that are also very important that must be held in balance. Or we must stop this kind of absolutism taking an increasing hold upon society. So just to conclude, there's a new moral absolutism taking hold. Equality has been placed above all other values. This is a great threat to freedom of religion and conscience, and other freedoms, by the way. This new absolutism violates church-state separation. The state is imposing itself upon the church. We are becoming non-conformists. Equality needs to be balanced against other values and rights. As I say, it needs to be relativized paradoxically. And the absolutist nature of this agenda needs to be made plain and visible. And I hope today's conference has been a contribution to that, and I hope the Iona Institute will continue to make a contribution to that in the years ahead. And thank you.
All been addressed to him can be shared by the other two speakers as well. But if you want to address a question and were frustrated but not being able to do so earlier, please feel free to do so now. Yes, the professor would like to speak. Is there a microphone, please, for? Here, use this one, sir.
I just would like to ask, raising the question about the Irish Constitution and Clause 44 that you mentioned. I was looking at this yesterday, and it says very clearly that under the Constitution there's freedom of religion, except, and there are limitations, for public order and morality. Now, of course, who's deciding what is the morality? And I think that might be the get-out. But it did seem to me there was considerable leverage there for taking action against some of these developments in Ireland. I mean, we haven't got a written constitution in England, and I don't know quite how that plays out against the European Convention of Human Rights as well. But I was wondering, I mean, has ever anything done about that in the courts?
We have, I hope he's still here. Have we got Professor Jerry White still here, who's a constitutional expert, or? No. Is he? Okay, he might be able to throw some light. There's only been, I think, a handful of cases in respect of that article.
The specific question raised about the conflict between equality and religious freedom hasn't really come up to date under in the context of the Constitution. But what can be said about the Constitution is that in the limited number of cases that have come before the courts have generally taken a very pro-religion point of view. And so, for example, have ruled that the state is obliged to make provision in its laws to accommodate religious practice, as in one particular case where a bylaw dealing with hours of trading made special provision for Jewish butcher shops to allow them to trade after a certain time of 6 o'clock on a Friday evening to accommodate the religious observance, the Jewish observance of the Sabbath. And Supreme Court more or less said that the state is obliged to do that, to accommodate religion in that way. There is one caveat to be added, though, and that is that many of these cases date from the 70s, 60s and 70s. We're in a new era now, and it remains to be seen how that might colour the views of a Supreme Court in the future dealing with these issues.
David, do you want to respond and stand?
I'll just add something to that. I mentioned the Employment Equality Act and Section 37, which protects religious employers. That was referred to the Supreme Court by Mary Robinson. There was a number of provisions in it, but Section 37 was one of the provisions referred to the Supreme Court, so as to test its constitutionality. And what was interesting is, when the then Attorney General was defending Section 37, he said, in light of the Constitution, if there was not a protection for religious organisations, the Act would be unconstitutional if it didn't have Section 37. Okay? So in other words, had the Employment Equality Act been passed without a protection for religious employers and religious freedom, then it would have fallen foul of the Constitution. I'm not sure what the exact reasoning of the Supreme Court was in that case, but it upheld Section 37 anyway. So that was, you know, a fairly recent case about 15 years ago. And it's as interesting then, just 4 short years later, the Equal Status Act goes through without it being tested by the Supreme Court and without anything equivalent to Section 37. So I just wonder what would have happened.
Now, it's my intention that we finish at 1 o'clock, which is in 15 minutes' time, and we will deal with as many questions or comments as possible. But if you could keep them as brief as you can, that would help. One over here on the left, then another one. Yes, you tried to get in earlier. But first of all, the gentleman here.
First of all, just a comment and then a question. Comment is I think we're duty-bound to support Iona. I mean, because it's producing a lot of debate, which is very good for society. And this is the first comment. We should contribute to this entity. I'm not in Iona, by the way, but we need to keep it going. Then a question for David is, the last slide you had there was about combating equality absolutism. You know, what can we do in this room as individuals? I mean, we're not necessarily presenters or people who go around with a presentation. What can the individuals in this room do?
Okay, thank you. And thank you. Okay, and thank you for the plug for the Iona Institute as well. By the way, has the clipboard been passed around for... Yeah, okay. So, I mean, one thing to do, of course, is attend events like this and become better informed. You know, when you see our e-letters drop into your mailbox, as it were, don't do what I sometimes do when I see these e-letters or whatever. I must read that tomorrow and then never get around to reading it. What we actually do nowadays, because I'm aware, I know how I am with these things, we just stick in bullet points as well. So even the bullet points give a summary, and then you can read on if you wish. So that's one thing, you know, to just get informed and keep informed. Inform as many others as you can, because more and more and more people need to be woken up to what's going on. So every person in this room can wake up one, two, or three people as to the reality of what's going on. You know, pass out some of the literature. We hope to prepare even a short paper in due course on, you know, examples of aggressive secularism in action and the sort of cases that are mounting all the time, you know, against people who believe, as we believe, about the family and life issues and what have you. Something else, of course, is don't be scared to go near your politicians. So let's say there is a hint that there's going to be a constitutional referendum on the definition of the family. You need to go straight into your politicians and say, I'm just not voting for you unless you go into your parliamentary party meeting and say, I'm not having this. And don't be plumbed by them. And don't say, oh, sure, I agree with you. And then you do, and then they do absolutely nothing whatsoever. Mm-hmm. That basically, you know, say, well, actually, did you speak out in your parliamentary party meeting? Did you say anything? Did you stand up against this? Well, okay, I'm not going to vote for you next time then. I'll vote independent. And by the way, like, what's devastating to our side in politics is because we are a loyal lot, we place a lot of value on loyalty, which is extremely laudable. But our loyalty must be to our values before party, okay? So we must be values voters. And if the party we voted for the last 150 years is abandoning those values, we must be prepared to put our values before our party loyalties. Our loyalty to our values is more important. And so you must be prepared, therefore. I mean, I'm a floating voter these days because there's no party that I see that really, you know, I can identify with. If I was in other countries, I would have parties I could identify with, but not here. So I'm a floating voter because of my values. And I think more of us need to become actually floating voters because that's more important than party loyalty. But anyway, as I say, get informed, keep informed, tell others about these issues, and don't be scared to write to, or better still, go in to see and eyeball your politician and become plumbos-proof.
The term plumbos will be explained to our two English visitors in due course. Sorry, can we come up to the second row? I said that we would go there first. The lady patiently waiting in the second row, and we'll come back to you.
Sorry, well, my question is very similar to the gentleman who's just spoken. We've heard what we're up against now, and we want to know exactly what we can do. And David has explained some of the things, but I would like to see our churches, I know they're trying to shut them up, but I would like to see the churches taking a stronger stance against the state and not allowing themselves to be shut up. And I think they're quite silent, afraid. I suppose they've been very badly abused. But I think that we need to also go to our churches and see that they too take a stronger stance, because the people feel that we have no leaders and we just have no idea what we can do. And when you go to your politicians, they just tell you, they tell you all kinds and go away. They don't really care whether you vote for them or not anymore, I don't think. So thank you very much. So that's what I want to say.
I mean, I absolutely agree with that, and I'm going to take an enormous liberty here now because, you know, as we know, the Catholic Church is extremely battered because, and understandably, because of the scandals, and a lot of the bishops feel they don't have the authority to speak out on anything. And I think, actually, curiously, this provides a fantastic opportunity for the Church of Ireland to become more outspoken on these issues because they don't have this horrible, you know, shadow over them that our bishops have over them. And, you know, in a strange kind of way, the minority status of the Church of Ireland in the South plays into, you know, into our hands to a certain degree, because by virtue of being a minority, it is accorded more respect. And so where you have Church of Ireland leaders speaking out on these things, I think actually they'll be more listened to than the average Catholic bishop would be listened to. So I know I've taken a liberty in saying that.
Now, I want to try and be fair. The next question is from the lady who you were with just a moment ago. If there are people who haven't already asked a question, I'm going to prioritise them. Right? If you haven't already asked a question, lady here first.
Please, what is the correct interpretation of render to Caesar what Caesar's and to God what God's?
The correct interpretation. I don't quite know actually what you mean by the question in this way, in this context, right? I mean, when Jesus answered the question, he was talking about money and about a coin and taxes and those kind of things. But it does... Maybe I'll just take a moment to say something that is in my mind, and partly in response to what David has just challenged me with. And it may seem slightly to go against some of what we've just been saying. What is in my mind, frankly, right now, is the question of Christ-likeness. Right? I mean, this is a Christian gathering. Christ is at the center. Christ is at the heart. And while I want to be values-driven, I want even more to be Christ-centered and to honor him. And therefore, in my communication with people, I don't want them to feel that I am against rights or that I am opposed to them as people. And when I look at Christ himself, I see somebody who, as we're told in Philippians and as we see in the Gospels, he emptied himself, he humbled himself, he took the form of a servant who had no rights at all. And that was something of his appeal in how he communicated with people. But he fought for the rights of others rather than just for his own. And so I want to come across not as somebody who's banging my fist on the table to demand my rights, but I want to come across as somebody who, because of my love of God and my belief in the equality, fraternity, and liberty, and brotherhood of all those things, you know, that I'm actually fighting for your rights, not for mine. Now, that's not answering your question, but it's just to do with the tone of how we come across. I think people are very susceptible these days to the tone of what you say as well as what you say. So I want to be careful in how I say it and how I express it, that it doesn't come across with harshness, with judgmentalism, and with finger-pointing, but that there's a Christ-likeness in it as I deal with these issues. I don't know if I'm making sense, but that's, I think, what I would want to contribute at this point. Gentlemen in the first row.
I think one of the important things that the church needs to do, all of the churches, is to take account of the way in which democracy has changed in the last 20 years. The whole notion of partnership and the structures of partnership, which contribute to the development of public policy and laws in the state. At any given day, there will be meetings involving non-governmental organisations with government departments all across the country, and the one group or the one body which you will never get as part of that partnership are the churches. There will be kind of offshoots of churches will participate. You'll get St. Vincent de Paul. You'll get bodies representing the managers of schools taking part in meetings. But you'll never get someone who's there as church, representing the church and bringing the position of the church into play. And I think that's a mistake that the churches have made over the last 20 years, and I think they need to get back into that space. A second point, I suppose, is a more theological one. I think since the Second Vatican Council, the whole notion of the people of God, which was supposed to bring in the sense that everyone was a member of the church and that the church wasn't defined by the hierarchy, it's simply what seems to have happened is that we've ended up with two churches. we've ended up with the people of God and the so-called institutional church. And it allows people to, on the one hand, say that they're Catholics, and yet at the same time they talk about the church as if it's something entirely separate from themselves. And if I can make one quick final point, it's just on Europe and the bodies like the Council of Europe. I think it's really important that we're specific and exact in how we talk about these things, because I think sometimes we inflate the importance of statements that come out of those bodies. They're important in that they influence things, but I think we can overinflate them. And we end up with, a report produced by one Member of Parliament at the Council of Europe, and it's presented as if this is Europe's opinion. And what we need to say is, actually, no, this isn't Europe's opinion. This is a Spanish socialist's opinion. It's come out as a report. It will go nowhere. We'll make sure it goes nowhere, and it doesn't actually represent the feeling of Europe. Thank you, sir.
Now, what I want to do at this point as we come to 1 o'clock is give each of the speakers a final word as they respond to all of the questions that they've heard in a general kind of way. And I'll ask Neil first, please.
Thanks. I'd like to just pick up, actually, follow on from a bit from what the bishop was saying about Christ-centeredness, or very much about, I think, how people come over as individuals. Because I've had this argument, in some respects, in England, with some people I've been working with on the more evangelical side of Christianity, and they've made comparisons with how a number of Muslim groups have pursued agendas in England and been fairly aggressive about it, and achieved, in some respects, what appear to be victories or government taking them seriously. And I said, yeah, that has been achieved. But what those groups haven't achieved is love or respect. They may have, at points, they may have achieved a result, but they haven't in the long run achieved a result where they are valued. And it's something that is concerning a number of Muslims in Britain, that their public image is very much negative, violence, aggression, when an awful lot of them are just getting on with the daily business of living and trying to live a decent life. So I think a lot of these things do come down to, in government and in society, people, whatever church they belong to, is how they live, and they are seen by their neighbours as decent people, and Christians being seen as playing an important role in society, just in the day-to-day business of society. In the long run, all the other issues are very important. The law, the legal arguments, all those things. But at the core of it, it comes down to what sort of people Christians are perceived to be within their society. And if people are sort of hearing people tatchel and whatever, complaining about Christians, they're all homophobes, bigots, and so forth, and then they think, well, actually, I know from Christians, they're decent people, they're nice people, they're people who go out and help their neighbours. At the end of the day, you're playing a long game, if you like, but that is what you should be doing. But at the end of the day, that has more influence in the long run. Thank you.
Professor Trigg.
Yes, well, I agree with that, but I think we should be speaking the truth in love, but we should be speaking what we regard as the truth. I think one of the reasons why the Pope came over very effectively in his visit last week to Britain was that he was, very gently, saying things that he believed were true. He was saying things about human nature, for instance, that he thought were true about humans. I was once a lay magistrate in Britain, and I often sat in the court and thought, what a mess these people are making of their lives. And if they really were living a Christian life, they wouldn't have done these things, and they are the people who are suffering from it. If you really believe what's good for people and what's bad, then it's very difficult not to appear judgmental, but at the same time, one has to be able to stand up for thinking and saying what you believe is true. Otherwise, you will see in the end the whole of our society fall to pieces, because I think if what we believe is true, then if people go against it, everybody will suffer. So there's a balance between being loving and respectful, but at the same time standing for something. And I think it's a very difficult balance, and the churches very often have got it wrong and said, you will do this, you will do that. But it's very easy for them to go to the other extreme and just say, we'll just listen, we'll just listen respectfully. The churches should also say something.
Should I give the last word to David?
Professor Trigg's comment there reminds me of a cartoon I once saw on the front of a British magazine. It had a generic clergyman, and there was a gladiator standing in front of him, and the gladiator just put a sword through him, and the clergyman says, "A good point, sir, well made." Right? So you can listen a bit too much. just a quick remark in response to the lady's question about the things that are God's and the things that are Caesar's. There will never be a definitive definition that allows us to say all the things that are definitely God's and all the things that are definitely Caesar's. But what I will say is this. It was Christianity that introduced the idea that there is a legitimate sphere for Caesar and a legitimate sphere for God or the church. Because the previous notion had basically been everything was Caesar's. And then in theocracies, of course, everything is God's. And there is no legitimate temporal sphere outside of the power of the church or the mullahs or whatever the case may be. So it's very important to say that always within the Christian tradition, there has been the notion that there are things that belong to Caesar's, things that belong to God, and that not everything belongs to Caesar. And while everything does belong in a certain sense to God, God allows the temporal sphere the freedom to order its own affairs within there. But there will always be disagreements. But does that belong to the temporal sphere purely, or does that belong in the religious sphere purely? And in the past, the church would often overreach and grab things that actually did belong to Caesar. And now it seems to me, and it's happened before in history many times, Caesar is overreaching and reaching into our lives and saying, you must behave in certain ways. You cannot be exempted from your obligation not to discriminate, okay, as this is defined by Caesar. So Caesar is now overreaching. And I suppose the final words I'd leave us with is, we need to point out that Caesar is in fact overreaching and try and stop it happening. Thank you.